good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king.
Hello.
But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station.
Hello.
They're my views. And in just a moment, we'll be talking to Professor David Livienthal. Professor, are you there? Professor Livienthal, are you there? Well, I think that I can hear Professor Livienthal, but he doesn't seem to be able to hear me. Professor.
Hello?
Yes, Professor, can you hear me? Can you hear me on the Professor?
Oh, no, I can't hear you.
Can you hear me at all? How about that? Can you hear me there? Well, I hope we're going to be able to hear Professor Livienthal. We should
Hello?
Be. Can you hear me at all? I'm going to ask to have the engineer come in and see if he can figure this out, why we can't seem to be getting through. Professor, can you hear me at all?
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
No, I can't hear you now.
You cannot hear me at all. Would you get David, please? Well, I have to apologize. We seem to be having some difficulty here. Professor Livienthal has written an amazing book. It's called... it goes into the background of the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Sorry.
Can you hear me at all?
Bring up the other... Hello?
Yes, can you... Could you go to a different telephone, because you should be able to hear us. Professor, could you go to a different telephone, do you think? Our guest is Professor David Livienthal.
Do you hear anything on that phone?
I can hear you just fine, Professor. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Can you hear me at all?
But you don't hear anything on the phone.
I don't hear him very well.
All right. Could you go to the other telephone, perhaps another telephone, and try? We'll be glad to call you right back.
Yeah, should I hang up?
Yes. Can you hear me now at all?
Only very low.
All right. How about if I put you up there? Can you hear me there?
That's a lot better.
All right. Fine. Then let's do that. Our guest is Professor...
It's still not normal, but it's better.
Well, we'll have to do the best we can until we can get an engineer to see it. All right. Fine. Professor Livienthal has written a book called The Present Danger, talking about the distortion of the First Amendment. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Yes, that's true.
All right, fine. Why don't you just start out? I've read the book. I know what your message is. I agree with it. It's beautifully said. Why do you think America's in danger today?
It's in danger for a lot of reasons. But apart from it, the external danger, which has been caused partly by neglect. We neglected all those people that we rounded up immediately after September 11th, but we already knew that there were a bunch of suspects out there, and we didn't pursue them, fearing that we'd be violating the law, violating the Constitution.
Well, we don't seem to be worried about that now, as we're just taking away the freedoms of the American people.
Now they're going too far in the opposite direction. But my book doesn't concern mainly international affairs. It's mainly concerned with... the domestic application of the First Amendment to things like obscenity or revolutionary groups, and then also church-state relations.
All right. Well, let's get into it. I thought your point was so beautifully made, where you actually pointed out that, of course, that when they wrote the First Amendment, the first thing they talked about was Congress shall pass or make no law respecting the establishment of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, pointing out that they were really very, very concerned about religion. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our special guest today is Professor David Livienthal. We're talking about his book, The Present Danger, which deals with the distortion of the First Amendment to the Constitution. So why don't you pick up the story there and what is happening today? You say that basically we are giving freedoms that our founding fathers never intended, and of course, on the other hand, restricting freedoms that our founding fathers never intended.
Yes, that's probably true on both sides. But the thing that's been most worrisome in the last 40 or 50 years is the overextension of liberty, so that we have revolutionary groups running around the country free to speak, to print, to organize, up to the point that they commit a crime, and only then is the government permitted to intervene. If you wait that long, it's often too late. The Oklahoma City bombing is an example of that, that these teachings of hatred for the government and the obligation to destroy it finally bore fruit. And the result was a bombing. But those teachings were in existence unimpeded and are still in existence unimpeded. So that the notion that the First Amendment protects those who want to destroy the country or destroy freedom, you know, that it's the freedom to destroy freedom, that I think is really easily proven to, not to be true. And yet it has prevailed on the court and in the law schools of the country and so on.
Now, can you hear me all right at the present time?
Well, your voice sort of goes in and out sometimes.
So all right, fine.
I'm listening to you carefully now.
Yeah. All right, fine. It may be that we have a short here, my engineers. I think we've got that. Hope we have that licked. Anyway, of course, you point out that certainly the First Amendment was never to be used as an excuse for or license for revolutionary activity in an effort to destroy the nation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, of course, how do you say that? I mean, we're told, of course, that there is total freedom of speech. It's all right to burn the flag, to desecrate the nation, as long as you don't, commit a crime. And they've made it no longer a crime to advocate revolution, as long as you don't actually carry out a revolution.
Well, it all started, as far as I can trace, it all started back around 1918 with Oliver Wendell Holmes, and pretty soon he got his friend Louis Brandeis aboard. And they initiated this doctrine of the court called the Clear and Present Danger Rule. And according to that rule, prior to that rule, if you were encouraging a crime, if you were urging through speech or print the commission of a crime, and particularly the crime of overthrowing the government, which is the worst crime, why, you could be thrown into jail. They didn't have to wait for you to do a single thing. Well, according to Holmes and then Brandeis as well, the government can't touch you regardless of what you're saying, regardless of what you're calling for, whatever crimes you might be calling for, until the point that those crimes are about to be done. Only at that point can government intervene and shut you down. Well, that gave legitimacy to communist parties, Nazi parties, Aryan Nation parties, the Ku Klux Klan, including loads of organizations running amok in our country that want to either destroy the country or destroy rights of large class of people like Jews, blacks, and so on. Well, that would always have been considered an abuse of the First Amendment. They're not part of the freedom of speech and press. And that's where we went wrong, and that's only the sort of the tip of the iceberg, because it's in the area of obscenity. And, you know, in one field after the other, what the court has done is act not in the name of the founders, really, but it read into the words of the founders the thought of somebody entirely different. And as far as I can tell, it was the thought of John Stuart Mill, the English political thinker of the mid-19th century.
Well, now, of course, the point you make so well in your book is that the foundation of America's freedom really came from the writings of John Locke, certainly of William Blackstone, of Montesquieu. This was the basis of our Constitution. Now, they don't teach this anymore. In fact, there's probably not one in 100 young people who's ever heard of John Locke or understands who William Blackstone were. And yet, these men, even though none of them were really Americans, or was Locke an American or not? He was English. None of them were really Americans, and yet it was their writings that were the foundations of our freedom.
Well, that's really true. We have Thomas Jefferson's notebooks contain almost a word-by-word paraphrase of a very famous work by John Locke, The Letter on Toleration. And they paid exceedingly great attention to those writings and were inspired by them, really. So that the neglect on the part of the law schools and, to some extent, the college and universities today is really it's because they'd like to leave those days behind. See, they don't want people to learn much about them because they're relatively unimportant. The Constitution, it's our Constitution. You know, we make it. We don't have to depend on these old, hands, the dead hand of the past. And I think that's one of the reasons for this kind of historical neglect. But it is a very severe one, and I agree with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, of course, the thing that is really so disturbing is that if we are to be a nation of law, then we have to abide by the laws of this nation. It would appear that there are many people, we're certainly within our universities and even within our courts, who don't believe in the law. They want to change it and remake America as they think it should be, rather than as it was in its years of greatness.
I believe that's absolutely true. And the way in which the Supreme Court and the courts generally now have become politicized, the way in which that's happened, the treatment of Judge Bork, the present treatment of Miguel Estrada, one of the nominees for an appeals court judgeship, these are all signs of something being wrong, because the Constitution is neither conservative nor liberal. It's what it is. And we should not distinguish between those people who favor a certain view of ours, let's say Roe against Wade, favor abortion, and then vote for judges who favor that. That isn't the way to do this. The thing to do, and the step that's overlooked, is we must study the Constitution itself. We must stick to it steadfastly. And whether these results or these policy results are to our liking or not, in a way, is entirely secondary. And that's what people don't understand today, because they start looking at these judges and say, conservative, well, he's going to be against this and this. Or, liberal, he's going to be for this and this. And it's certainly a degeneration of the way in which the Constitution has to be regarded.
Well, now, one of the points that you make out is that this whole thing of obscenity, and, of course, we see Mr. Mapplethorpe, who, of course, puts a cross in a jar of urine and has pictures of a man engaged in some bizarre postures. We won't really describe them. People who haven't seen them, this is certainly not art of any sort. And other people, and in the name of art, why, of course, this somehow is excusable, and yet it really is obscene. And yet, of course, the court says, well, if there's anything, even the slightest hint that there might be some redeeming social quality, why, it's all right. What have they totally changed the meaning of the First Amendment, haven't they?
I think you're certainly right. From the very beginning, Dr. Stan, obscenity was excluded by everybody who thought about the First Amendment. Everybody knew anything about the First Amendment. It was excluded because the freedom of speech and press were not thought to include certain kinds of things. For example, slander or libel. Why, you couldn't do that. You can. It's an abuse of words. You're using words to harm. Well, there are many examples of that, and obscenity was a sort of blatant example of that. And, of course, they had in mind pornography, which is the worst form of obscenity, the most primitive form of obscenity, as well as the extension of the thing, and what we'd call dirty books and dirty pictures. And they didn't think that any civilized society could tolerate that. So that the notion today that there's a right to pornography, well, that goes even beyond the Supreme Court itself. But by its rulings, by the way in which it's tightened up and restricted the very definition, the legal definition of obscenity, the court has kind of let us in for this. So law enforcement officials are demoralized. They feel that they can't go after the things that in the past they have gone after.
Well, of course, you point out in your book that it was recognized that a society cannot exist if you have immorality becoming the way of life. You have to have a moral standards, and sexual excesses certainly erode the very fabric of the society. It would almost be as if somebody were trying to destroy the very soul of America with what's going on today.
Well, I think that's true, and you know, to some extent, I've pondered this question often as to whether the intention behind those who are propagators of this kind of stuff, whether it's in movies or on television or elsewhere, but I've wondered whether they know what they're doing. Now, in some cases, they do. Well, what they don't plan to destroy the country. What they wanted to do is destroy the old religions. There's a very strong anti-religious bias that you can find in certain quarters in the country, and they'll do anything to break it down because these people regard religion as mere superstition and bad in all ways. So to break down the morality connected with religion is a good way for them to go about this. And I think in some cases there is a serious intent behind the what looks like the mere filth and the propagation of filth. So in a way it wouldn't make any difference what their motive is, because to me these people like leeches, you know, sort of the hanging on to an animal or to a body politic and drawing its blood out. And, over a period of time, we've only seen this for, God, since the 1960s, really, but maybe in less than 30 years. But give us another 30 years, and you'll wonder what's going to be of us.
Well, it's sort of a patient gradualism as we gradually erode the foundation of our society. And as Alexander Pope had written so well, vice is a monster of such horrible mien as to be hated is but to be seen, but seen too oft, too familiar with her face. We first endure and then tolerate and then embrace. And that really seems to be what's happening here in America today. But one of the things, at one time, you could have local laws on obscenity. There were local laws, and sure. Yet those laws have been eroded at the national level. Where did the federal government get the right to do that? These were all initially under states' rights, not federal rights.
It all happened by an interpretation of the 14th Amendment given by the Supreme Court, which drew the states into the guarantees of the First Amendment as interpreted by the Supreme Court. So that one can really prove, and I have a little chapter in the book that tries to show that the 14th Amendment, first of all, that the Bill of Rights was meant to have relation whatsoever to the states. It was not a protection of rights in the states. The states already had their own state constitutions. But what happened in the course, particularly of a certain point in the 20th century, was that this all started to get terribly confused. And the court, in its own name, started to interpret what the states did as covered by the First Amendment. And therefore, they read into the word liberty in the 14th Amendment the liberties of the Bill of Rights, and particularly the First Amendment. Well, when that started to happen, all these cases, which had been local cases or state cases, could be challenged in federal courts. And so the whole thing started to devolve and move toward the federal judiciary, and all became nationalized by the very interpretation given to the 14th Amendment by the court itself.
And of course, though, that this had nothing to do with what the people who ratified the 14th Amendment were talking about. They didn't imagine what this was going to be when they ratified it, did it, or how it would be misused at a later time?
No, I think that's absolutely and completely right. It was one of the great revolutions. It's ironical, Dr. Stan, but when Hamilton defended the idea of judicial review, you know, that the Supreme Court could pronounce and had to pronounce on the constitutionality.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, because we're going to have to go to a break, but I really want to get into this. This is so vitally important.
This whole
idea of judicial review is the very heart of the problem that threatens America today. Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years. Stan here, and I just want to mention that if you feel run down, if you feel that you need more energy, have you ever considered taking Be Alive Royal Jelly? Now, I've taken this for about 10 years on my own, and along with my family, we've been very, very satisfied with it. And recently, why, the Be Alive people approached us and asked if we'd like to have them sponsor us for a month. So we certainly agreed to that because we think it's a great product, and I think you will too. Let me suggest that you call 1-866-233-7500. That's 1-866-233-7500. The product is sold with a money-back guarantee. So give them a call at 1-866-233-7500 and simply ask to learn more about Be Alive Royal Jelly. I think that you'll be very, very satisfied with this product.
Hello, this is health journalist Bill Sardi, and there's no better time to establish a biological response kit in your home. In an age when we hear about biological threats, more common are cases of E. coli in our food, cryptosporidium in our tap water, and staph germs, viruses, and molds in our air conditioning system. Why be a sitting duck and run to the doctor after you've got a problem? Why not take something to stay healthy, like Alamex, the all-new 100% pure allicin garlic extract? You won't find Alamex in stores, but you'll find it by calling 866-405-4000. Alamex is equivalent to 15 cloves of fresh crushed garlic. And guess what? It's odor-free. Call 866-405-4000.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I certainly want to mention the book that we've been carrying recently, which we've had just a tremendous response from, and that is, of course, Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. Now, we're being told by the government that there's going to be a very good likelihood of a biological or chemical or nuclear attack on America. I don't know whether that's going to happen or not. But they seem to be convinced it is. At least they're trying to convince us. And then, of course, what do you do if there's a biological attack? I mean, how do you protect yourself? We don't have suits. We don't have these space suits like they're giving the military. And there's certainly not enough a vaccine for most of the things that they could use. And having talked to Dr. Kenneth Alaback, who was the number two man in the Soviet biowarfare unit, he said the only thing to do is boost your immunity. And I agree. And Dr. Blaylock has a whole unit in his book about how we actually boost our immunity. Call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life and our four-tape interview, Life-Saving Secrets. Call right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Professor David Lilienthal. We're talking about his book, Present Danger, and I will tell you, you know, I read a lot of books, but this one is really a wonderful, wonderful book. It's one of those books you read a sentence and you say, I want to read that again, because there's something so important in that. And, of course, one of the things that Professor Lilienthal brings out is the fact that when the First Amendment was written, they meant to guarantee the right of the states to have their own religion. Most of the states, or at least the majority of the states, there was a state religion. Some of them were Protestant and some of them were congregational. Well, why don't you address that? Because the wording of the First Amendment is very specific. It's not vague in the least bit. They knew exactly what they were saying. Would you make out the points that you brought out in your treatise?
Sure, Dr. Stan. Well, the first part of the First Amendment. The First Amendment has really two halves. even though they're not equally long, but two different subjects. The first is religion. So Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And it's after that that the matters of freedom of speech, press, etc. are gone into. So now what's the meaning of that thing? Well, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Well, that isn't the same thing as saying make no law to establish a national an establishment of religion. That's not the same thing. There's something broader in this respecting an establishment of religion. Well, what was an establishment of religion? Well, that was known as, you can see it from the case of England, an established church in England is that church which has been singled out to be the preferred church for all official purposes, for coronations, for everything that you can think of. And it often was supported by the state that singled it out. And in England, it's the king or the queen who are the head of that church. So an established church is a very particular thing. You have to have many religions or churches for an establishment to take place because it selects one of them for a preferred treatment. And as you were saying, in the case of the American states, why I think just about half of them had one form or the other of an establishment of religion. It could have been Protestantism. It could be Christianity. It could be a particular church. So, but what is meant by Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion? I must say I got interested in the First Amendment by worrying about that little word respecting. And all it meant was regarding or concerning. And why not say it more directly if all you meant was Congress shall not establish a national religion? And that is the form when this thing was all being discussed, when the First Amendment was being discussed in Congress and in its committees, that was the form that it took at a certain point. They were very direct. Congress shall not establish a national religion. Well, by deduction, really, one can show that what that had in mind was that Congress shall not establish a national religion nor do anything in connection with the state establishments of religion. See, and the word respecting an establishment of religion actually has that dual coverage without, you know, saying so explicitly. The states, and the reason for this was really plain. There were very powerful anti-federalist forces in the various states, and if you wanted them to go along with the new Constitution, you had to assure them that the new national government would not be so powerful that it would be able to remove the particular religious establishments in those particular states.
All right, let's go to Ralph, who's calling us here from Oklahoma. Hi, Ralph. Does you have a question or comment?
Dan, how are you?
Doing fine.
Yes, had a question for your guest there. I've got some information from, you know, David Barton has some research he'd done. I don't have it before me at the moment, but Fisher Ames was the primary writer of the First Amendment, from what I'm looking at or what I remember, and the first two drafts that he submitted for that didn't have religion. It was denomination.
All right, let's ask Professor Lowenthal about that. Would you like to comment on that Fisher Ames authorship?
The First Amendment was introduced into the House of Representatives by none other than James Madison. And in the form that Madison introduced it in, it was even longer. There were more than 10. I think there were 12 actual amendments that were being proposed. And there were some that were completely discarded by the Joint Committee of Congress that led to the final decision. So that in the course, it's really very hard to say that anybody was really the author of the entirety of the First Amendment.
We're going to have to just interrupt you. They'll be back in just a moment here.
Yeah.
Well, if there's any one tape that you should hear, it's my talk on geopolitics, an untold story that is vitally important if America is to survive as a free nation. It goes into the background of the forces that have created the wars of the 20th century, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. We go into the ideological and the spiritual battle behind the forces that have moved America from crisis to crisis and are currently undermining the very fabric of our society. That number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and the tape, Geopolitics. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of my talk on geopolitics.
Well, this is Arthur Stan, and I just want to mention a couple of other products we have. As you know, we carry the Miracle 2 soap products, and I never thought when I was practicing medicine we'd be selling soap, but these really are unusual products. We can't make any medical claims for them, but I will tell you that so many of the people who use Miracle 2 soap products really do swear by them, and they feel that they've helped them in many ways. So if you'd like to try them, all we can do is suggest you try them. There's a soap, there is a moisturizing soap, there is a neutralizer, which some people feel helps them with their heartburn. It's just a very alkaline solution. There is a gel and a certainly a lotion, and you can get them all by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. The one thing I can guarantee is it's excellent soap, because I've used it for a good period of time, and it really has many uses, but I think that you'll like it. Give it a try. Miracle 2 Soap Products, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And I'll tell you, we have a tremendous return clientele. The people use the products, they come back again. The other thing is, if you have children or grandchildren that you love and they're in the government schools, then why, consider getting a phonopoly set to teach the children how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. It's basically 5 board games and 2 bonus games, played just like Monopoly. But the advantage to it is, of course, that at about 16 hours, you can begin to reprogram the mind, so children will begin to break words down and pronounce them phonetically. And you don't even have to be a child. Older people can do this as well. Even old people like me can learn from benefit from learning the basic rules of the English language and the basic sounds of the English language. And when an A is an AA or an RA, call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. The product, Phonopoly. Well, our guest this afternoon is the Professor David Lowenthal, and of course we have with us on the line Ralph calling from Oklahoma. Ralph, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I've always wondered, since I became aware of this a few years ago, that if you notice, all of the documents are always dated in the year of our Lord. So it was taken for granted that this was a Christian nation.
Well, of course, this was the tradition at that time, and everybody knew it at one time. They sure don't know it today.
Right. Well, anyway, the denomination thing, you know, that was taken for granted that we were a Christian nation. But when they left that out and put religion in there, I think it's opened this can of worms that plagues us today.
Well, of course, the one thing was that they did not want to have any one religion, because there were people here, there were some Catholics, there were a lot of Protestants, there were Congregationalists, there were the Huguenots were here, there were Quakers here, so they did not want to say we were... They did say there was a right of religion. That was what they said, and I think the First Amendment held up very well for 150 years.
Oh, yeah.
Anything else you want to say, Ralph?
Well, yeah, as far as what you just mentioned, though, wouldn't that come under denomination rather than religion?
Well, I think that they thought the religion was a better because if you read what Jefferson said, he said he wanted people of all religions to be able to, and I have the autobiography of Thomas Jefferson. He said he wanted the Hindus and the Jews, anybody could come here and live. Now, he recognized that the foundation of our country was based upon Judeo-Christian concepts, and they really came out of the Bible and the writings then of people like Locke and Blackstone and Montesquieu. But, of course, they did not want to say one religion or another religion. There was to be freedom of religion, but everybody at the time knew that this was built upon the Judeo-Christian concept. Hey, thanks so much,
Ron.
Okay,
thank you, Doctor and Professor. Bye.
And of course, now of course, you point out that the founders of this country really felt that you had to have religion to have freedom. You could not have a free society without a religious society. Would that be a valid statement?
Pardon me, was that what?
We had to have a religious society to be a free society. In other words, if you took the religion out of society, now you would no longer have the foundation upon which freedom could exist.
Yes, I think that's certainly true. There's a wonderful statement by George Washington in the farewell address. I think also the founders varied to some extent as to the degree of their animosity toward the established religions, the old, by established, I simply meant the traditional or older religions. Jefferson was not as kindly toward Christianity or toward the established religions, the general religions, as was Washington. But as a general matter, if one had to make a kind of summary statement, I believe they all understood that if you weaken religion too much, you're removing one of the great underpinnings of American democracy. And nobody stated that better than Alexis de Tocqueville, that youngish French aristocrat who came to our shores in the early 1830s and with a friend of his, and went back and wrote what even today, by today, is still the very best book ever written about American democracy, called Democracy in America. And he makes that perfectly plain, that democracy depends on religion. And so if religion is weakened, and I think to some extent that's true today, even though it's sort of springing up in new forms everywhere. But still, if religion is weakened, that's going to be accompanied by a weakening of the moral fiber and the essential underpinnings of democracy itself.
Well, how did the Supreme Court get from the First Amendment as it was written and interpreted by our founding fathers to where we are today, where there is really a hostility on the part of government or in the Supreme Court and their decisions towards such things as the Ten Commandments, which is the foundation of our modern-day law? I mean, thou shalt not kill. That is, of course, and thou shalt not steal. And, these were the foundations upon which Blackstone was writing his commentaries on the laws of England, which became the foundation of American law. How did we get to the mess we are today?
Well, that story took me about almost 300 pages to tell completely, but I'll try to summarize it very, very briefly. It was by importing into the interpretation of the First Amendment, importing into it the views that prevailed among the justices in the 1940s, the 50s, the 60s, and all the way up to the present. And those views were often hostile to the fundamental philosophical notions of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. They no longer believed in natural rights. There was a very strong movement in the 19th century toward historicizing things, and evolution came up at the time, so that the currents in the air were entirely different, the intellectual currents, than the ones that prevailed in our founders' time. And the court and the justices, and even today, the law schools look down upon these older views of our founders as benighted and as false and benighted, so that they're improving on them. See, they don't regard what they're doing as sort of falsifying, but improving on the older interpretations. And so they give religion, for example, instead of thinking of the actual religions that are protected, they gave religion itself such a broad interpretation that it was no longer recognizable as religion itself. They extended it to encompass all belief as such, whether strictly religious, involving a deity or not. So bit by bit, by adopting modern currents of thought, including relativism and subjectivism and a lot of things floating around among the educated classes in our country, but by applying those to the Constitution, it became a different document. And that's the sad story. So it was insufficiently clinging to the fundamental concepts built into the Constitution and into the Declaration, but by insufficiently clinging to them, by not understanding them or holding on to them, that we got into our present pass.
And, of course, this is the thing that people don't understand, is that, you know, we were meant to be a nation of laws, and the laws would not be changing, you know, just by the whims of men, because, of course, when you have a society ruled by men, you have really an oligarchy. We were to be ruled by law, and that was the foundation of our republic. And I was so interested that, you know, the foreword to your book was written by Harvey C. Mansfield, who was the professor of government at Harvard University, who seemed to really, of course, support what you were saying here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I have a few friends around the country who think highly of my views, but, you see, making a dent into the, for want of a better term, a kind of liberal judicial establishment, which is practically without challenge in the law schools and in the colleges and universities. You know, occasionally you'll come on somebody who's sort of thought for himself, often of views that seem more conservative, but still are derivative from the Constitution. And sometimes you'll come across a teacher like that, but as a general matter, the conformity of view on this subject of the First Amendment is simply enormous, and making a small dent in it is extremely difficult. But Harvey Mansfield, and if you notice on the cover, Marianne Glendon, a professor at the Harvard Law School, they think very highly of the book, and I'm pleased with that.
Well, because you've taught political science at Boston College since 1966, and, of course, you know, but when you begin seeing people from Harvard endorsing this, and think what you will of Harvard, it's still one of the finest schools in the country, but we ordinarily associate that with all these radical ideas, and yet there are some people at Harvard who cling to this, the traditional views of the permanency of law and the permanency of the Constitution. I'll have to admit I was pleasantly surprised to see the endorsements of your views.
Well, I wasn't surprised by, that my friends endorsed my views, but I must say that everywhere where you find somebody who's sort of thinking for himself and sort of digging for himself and coming up with views that are not in the mainstream of present-day jurisprudence, when you find that, that's like a gem, and you have to cherish something like that. If among your listeners there are young people who happen to have teachers of that kind who willing to have them read other things and develop their own thoughts on the First Amendment, why, they're very, very fortunate. So that it's not that they're not there, but they're sort of overwhelmed by a kind of conformity which is very difficult to break through.
Well, of course, I don't know if you know the community I live in, but it's Santa Cruz, California, and we have the University of California at Santa Cruz, and even the man who put this together, Dean McHenry, said he was horrified when he saw, you know, this wonderful dream of this ideal Oxford-type college he was putting together, and when he suddenly realized what had happened, and suddenly he has this school where everything is radical. I mean, you know, the Marxists and the conservatives on the campus, we have, of course, we have Bettina Apthaker here, and we have the lady with the Afro hairdo. I forget her name, it escapes me, but she was the leader of the Communist Party, and you know, Angela Davis. I mean, they're the conservatives up on the campus, if you can believe it. But of course, you know, the tragedy is, of course, they don't educate, they indoctrinate, and education has to be the opportunity to see all sides and to go back and understand the foundation of this wonderful document, this Constitution. And as you bring out so well, that, you know, without the writings of Locke and of Blackstone, could you talk a little bit about Blackstone? Because most of our listeners don't even have any idea who he was or who John Locke was and why he had such a profound impact on the thought process of our founders.
Well, you actually identified him very well before, Dr. Stan. Blackstone is famous for his commentaries on the laws of England. This written roughly in the middle of the 18th century. And these volumes are still obtainable today. I got my copy in secondhand bookstores and, you know, several years ago, but still they were available and they probably are still available. And some new editions have come out as well. Well, it sounds as if this has no interest for Americans, after all, commentaries on the laws of England. But that really is far from the truth. Blackstone was the main teacher, law teacher, of our founding fathers, the primary one. I mean, there were others as well, but he was the primary one. They revered him. They knew he was talking about a monarchy and a monarchy with an established church. They knew all that. But they also thought that fundamental elements of Blackstone could be taken out and applied to a democratic republic. And that's what they tried to do. They thought so highly of him that, you know, his name is mentioned very, very frequently by them. Blackstone was one of the greatest defenders of the freedom of the press. And Blackstone thought it was not only consistent with the idea of what's called subsequent punishment, of allowing you to publish something, but if it is dangerous and harmful, of punishing you after you publish it. But he thought that these two things were mutually necessary. You have freedom of the press. You get rid of the censor. And Blackstone was one of the greatest champions of the freedom of the press. But you must hold people responsible for what they write and what they speak. And if they say things or print things that are really libelous, for example, or obscene or dangerous one way or the other, why, they will have to, you know, meet a challenge in the courts of law. So Blackstone is an eminent person. As for John Locke, John Locke was an English political philosopher who was, again, revered by the founding fathers. He wrote two treatises of government. He wrote Letters on Toleration. He wrote some strictly philosophical works, Essay on the Human Understanding, concerning human understanding. But a very, very eminent man, very likely the most influential political philosopher of the entire 18th century, because it was in the 18th century, even though he wrote in the latter 1600s, but it was in the next century that his views started to flood all over the globe and, of course, affected our founders as well. And it was from Locke. It was Locke's, to put it in a nutshell, the fundamental ideas of the Declaration of Independence derive almost directly from John Locke. So if you realize that, you can see how important the man's thinking was to Americans. You might say that we were the first country entirely founded on Locke's political principles.
And, of course, he wrote about nature's God and nature's law and the fact that because there was this natural law that men were entitled to be free and they had a right to life, liberty, and property. And those phrases were really his phrases, weren't they?
Yes, they were directly in the Second Treatise on Government. And you're quite right. Life, liberty, and property were the three that he mentioned. But I often had wondered where the phrase pursuit of happiness came from. It turns out that also came from Locke, but it came from his Essay on Human Understanding, where he speaks of that as a fundamental characteristic of human beings, that they seek happiness in different ways and must be permitted to pursue that in their different ways. And without going into too many technical details, Locke was, if I had to say, what one thinker most inspired the founding fathers in his general notion of what society is all about, it would have to be John Locke.
And the fact that we just don't teach this in so many classes today or many universities, and of course everything is, well, yeah, what do you think the things ought to be? And men ought to be free just because they ought to be free. And yet if you don't understand what went before, you can't understand the foundations of our freedom. Let's go quickly to Roger. Roger, we're about out of time. Do you have a quick question?
Yeah, and by the way, I'm so glad you mentioned the court's wholesale invention of the incorporation doctrine out of the 14th, and that being a large part of the federal power grab.
Roger, have a quick question, Roger.
Yeah, now we correctly criticize the commie Chinese for requiring registration of churches when we have de facto registration of churches by violating the nor prohibit the free exercise clause and forcing churches to act as tax collection instruments for the government.
That's only because, of course, they've taken 501c3 of corporate status. At that point, they become agents of the government. Thanks so much there. We're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Professor David Lowenthal. His book, The Present Danger, it's available at Amazon.com or bookstores.
Yes, it's also available at 50% off. It ends up by being $9 at the publisher. It's Spence Publishing in Dallas, Texas. Do you have the 800 number there?
That's 888-773-6782. That's 888-773-6782. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Dr. Spence.
Really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, that was Professor David Lowenthal from Boston City College. Hope you enjoyed it. And, of course, we'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up our program here at Radio Liberty.
The Anglo-American establishment gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who were actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and a few people have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a Confession of Faith, which was attached to his first 5 wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let me just mention, if you're out there and you would like to get yourself a big Berkey, this is a water filter, and of course, if anything were to happen to our water supply, you'd want a way to purify it. The big Berkey is the standard. It's been used. The technique has been used by missionaries going back, 180 years or so. We don't have time to tell you exactly how it works, but it's simply a filtration method using ceramic filters filled with charcoal. Now, the Big Berkey is not available in California or Iowa, but of course, if any other place in the country, you can get those. We hope we'll have something sometime for you in California. We don't have it quite yet, but if you'd like to get a Big Berkey, ordinarily they're $279. We provide them for $239.95 plus shipping, and we'll give you 2 of our tape sets, any 2 of the 4 tape sets you'd like to get. If you just call us at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask about the Big Berkey water filter, something I think very important for every family to have right today. And then we have another wonderful book. It's The Smoking Gun we've been looking for many years on the Kennedy assassination. And, of course, it's based upon the papers of Mr. Robert Crowley, the deputy assistant director of covert operations for the CIA, why he and James Angleton and the others decided they would have to kill Kennedy. And, of course, they felt they were doing the country a real service. Of course, they had to get the FBI to go along with it, and they had to kill the people who tried to find out who killed Kennedy. The fascinating book written based upon Mr. Crowley's papers and, of course, available after he died. Available, regicide. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Fascinating reading. It's a smoking gun we've needed. And, of course, if the CIA could get away with it 40 years ago, what are they getting away with today? Should we be concerned about the story? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there listening to us believe in what we're talking about, that a country loses its freedom when the good people aren't involved. The liberals, the people on the extreme left who are involved, of course, many of them are being totally misled. They're actually backing the plans of the very people they hate and despise the most. They think if we could only put all power with the government, that we could take care of those wicked capitalists who are exploiting the common people. without understanding the whole socialist and communist movement has been financed by the Rockefellers and the Fords and the Carnegies and these people for many, many years through organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations that pushes socialism, that pushes centralization of power in government, that does everything they can to undermine our Constitution, because the Constitution is our protection against tyranny. Liberty and limited government are synonymous, and tyranny and total government are synonymous, and we're moving rapidly towards total government in the name of fighting those wicked terrorists, who, of course, we financed for so many years. If you don't believe that, you really need to, of course, get my video entitled 911, Contrived or Desperate Deception, another excellent video, all available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, but of course, we hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, reaching out across America with the news you're not going to get elsewhere. And of course, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, you simply call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, and our latest newsletter deals with the possibility of a biological warfare attack on American people, say, that could never happen here. I would ask you why it can't happen. There's no question at all in my mind that the AIDS virus is a new virus. It was never occurred before. Just like chronic fatigue, these are all new. And we have the government testimony by Dr. MacArthur talking about how we had the ability to create these new viruses. This is 1969. And for $10 million, they could produce them. And there were some moral considerations about it. If you'd like to see the testimony, just give us a call and ask for Dr. MacArthur's testimony. And about 6 years later, the six first cases of these diseases appeared. And, of course, all of them, actually, all the AIDS cases have a mycoplasma. We have the patent that the government took out for the genetically engineered mycoplasma that all AIDS patients have. Isn't that interesting? Gee, I wonder why. I wonder why in Botswana today, 40% of the adult population is infected. That's either a terribly failed public health policy or a very successful genocidal policy. And if the American people aren't concerned about what our policy has brought in Africa, why should we be concerned about the possibility that the same thing might happen here in America? Yes, a biological attack. AIDS has already killed almost 30 million people, another 42 million infected now worldwide, and, of course, devastating the population. Well, we won't get into that entire subject, but let me just suggest that there is a very real possibility of a biological attack on America, and if it comes, it's not going to come from Saddam Hussein, I can assure you. So you better find out what's going on. You better help us get the word out while we still have that opportunity. Join the Radio Liberty family. Tell others about our programs. Encourage them to go to our website at radioliberty.com and pull down our newsletters and read them. You can actually get all the newsletters directly from us. We have them bound now going back many years, and they're available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you want to get what the enemy says, get the Sustainable Development Syllabus. We've actually summarized their global biodiversity assessment, where they actually say that the great enemy of the monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, the Muslim religion, well, we're going to war with the Muslims. We'll be killing a lot of Muslims here very soon, and I don't think it's going to stop simply with Iraq. But, of course, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Consider joining the Radio Liberty family and helping us in this truly epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure, and pray for America. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
Mm-hmm.